Good morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, LaTanya Sweeney of Carnegie Mellon University, where she is professor of computer science, PhD from MIT, and one of the world's leading privacy experts. We're really privileged to have her visiting Harvard this term. And she's been involved in very serious and important research, some of which I cite in, if you go look up LaTanya Sweeney in the index of Longa Bits, you'll find it there. But also important work on data privacy in regards to medical information, which she has been a significant consultant to the U.S. Congress on what the standard should be. So, privileged to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks. It's great to be here. And I think it's really great to have a quantitative reasoning class because, you know, you're thinking, probably after looking at Blown to Bits, you're sort of like overwhelmed saying, okay, privacy is, as the saying goes, privacy is dead. Let me just try to survive somehow without it. But what I want to kind of, the big picture of what I really want to say today is give you a sense that, well, one, for lots of reasons, privacy can't be dead. But more importantly, that the kind of skills that you develop, just simple quantitative reasoning skills, can actually solve some of the most interesting problems. So at the one hand, you might be overwhelmed by what's happening, but we're going to look at a real-world problem, and then we're going to talk about how we might go about solving it, and we're going to find a solution that's certainly within grasp of this course. So let me thank you guys again for being here, and thank Harry Lewis in particular for having me. So this is the phrase, bioterrorism surveillance. This is the problem we're going to solve. Sounds pretty daunting, doesn't it? We're in quantitative reasoning 48, and we're going to solve bioterrorism surveillance. But we are. In particular, here's the problem statement. So you're going to, and I've got it adapted to the school situation. So given privately held school data, how can we know whether there is some unusually high absenteeism indicative of a bioterrorist attack? Without knowing any particular school's absenteeism. So that doesn't sound very real world. But one of the things that you can convince yourself of right away is that I could replace school with other things like pharmacies or hospitals or Radio Shack or Home Depot for fertilizer sales and things like that. And then I think you get to see that solving it even in the space of school absenteeism is actually solving a problem that's much bigger than just school absenteeism. Though I should tell you, the real-world problem actually was school absenteeism, among the others, too. So let me just say very quickly a little bit about myself. I run the Data Privacy Lab at Carnegie Mellon. We have been involved over the last 6 years in almost every real-world privacy conflict that made the New York Times. It was the sort of a pattern that if you got sued, we somehow got involved on one side or the other. And so we've had a lot of this sort of immediate research come up with a real-world practical solution. Sometimes it pushed the umbrella in computer science. Most often it actually did, so it was kind of interesting. And then other times solutions were just able to come out of the community. We do two kinds of work in the popular media. Most of the citations are all to work that we've done on the data detective side. That is, how do you learn sensitive information? How do you take tweets and find something sensitive about a person? How do you predict a person's social security number? That kind of thing. And if we're really good at being a data detective, then we can be a data protector. That is, we sort of know what it is we need to control the learning on and how we can go about doing that. And so it's the data protective side that we're going to talk about today as we solve our problem. One of the things that's interesting about us, though, is we sort of have been really good at finding a sweet spot where answers could give me both privacy and utility. Normally, if you listen to a conversation, especially if it's in D.C., it's very polarized. In order to have something useful or good, keep the utility, then I can't have privacy, or to have privacy, I have to give up the utility. And what we care about is the sweet spot where you can basically enjoy both. And that's what we'll be looking for today. Now, we've worked with all kinds of data. I'm not going to take our time to go through all of our solutions, but some of them are in the medical space. Some of them are tracking people over websites where they've been and predicting behaviors and information about them, using publicly available webcams to track people, We've done other kinds of surveillance system, how to anonymize text, how to anonymize video in real time, and matching DNA back to people, and a lot of information on Social Security numbers. Identity Angel is a problem, a program that CBS ran a long series on for almost a year, sort of finding people who were vulnerable to identity theft on the web. It was a program that would automatically find them and try to notify them as to what they could do. And most recently, you say you wave hi and we grab your fingerprints from a high-resolution camera. So there's been a lot of work that we've done. If you were to look at it, if any of you are in computer science and you were to say, well, where does this fit into computer science? It fits in nowhere and everywhere at the same time. So this is sort of a map on this side is primarily computer science areas. You can see we've sort of been involved in work across lots of different areas. And on the right-hand side, the work has been equally potent in society as well. Okay, so that's sort of the background of, or the breadth of sort of what I've been up to the last 6 to 10 years. And I think, so let's now begin to tackle our problem. The first thing we've got to do is we've got to get Chapter 2, the blown to bits part, get our minds synced around that. And I think it made a good case that there has been, well, the whole book actually does, that there's been, certainly been an information explosion, a dramatic increase in the amount of information captured on individuals. There have been tons of studies since I did this particular one in 2001, but the actual work was done in like 2000, about how much information is being captured. People have used different measurements. But let me give you a sense of, let me give you just one example. I think this sort of conveys the difference of how much information there is. So anyone in this room who was born in the United States, at the time of your birth, this is the information that was collected about you. Now, most of it showed up on your birth certificate. And the copy of your birth certificate is usually held in a regional office. And that's pretty much all the information was known about you at the time of your birth. But today, with the use of the electronic birth certificate database, the following fields are collected on each birth in the United States, automatically drawn from the hospital information system, and then augmented sometimes with interviews with the mom while she's still in the hospital. A copy is sent on to the local office, another copy is sent on to the state, and then another copy is sent on to CDC. It has a lot of interesting information, sort of like APGAR scores, or sort of a version of intelligence scores, lifestyle information about the mom and the dad, as well as their educational levels. And it also included, you could actually infer abortions and things like that from the data. It's pretty amazing, right? So I think that gives you a sense. There's a heck of a lot of data out there. And there is. There's just a lot of that kind of explosion in the collection process. Has not just been in birth records, but has appeared all over the place in lots of different areas. And anybody have a sense of why? Why do you think that's happened? What has changed so that all of a sudden we've just become a data collection hungry society? Well, it might be that demand is increasing for more information, and that's creating more information. Anybody else have some thoughts about
it? It's just really easy to keep it and keep track of it. Look, with computers, you don't have to have lots of papers. You don't need lots of personnel filing it. You just enter it in, and it's there.
Right. I mean, in some sense, I think you're both right. I would articulate it a little bit differently. I would say that the cost of storage has gotten almost zero. And in fact, if I use Google, it is zero, because it doesn't cost me anything to store. And as the price of just simply storing the data, demand increases, more people want more data, and then because I have this opportunity cost, I just start recording things and I never throw them away. And so that's been basically the main problem. Around 2000, so the 1990s, we saw this huge surge in data collections, and we could go about all the different areas that the surge happened. Around 2000, a new behavior started happening, and that were all these efforts who said, hey, there's a lot of data out there. Let's find ways to put it together. And what I do find interesting now when I look at the data sharing environment is that there is this interesting pushback. Anybody want to figure out why they think there's been a pushback? Why are all of a sudden, so there's certainly the data is being collected. we started the decade with people wanting very much to fuse the information together. Now all of a sudden there's pushback on this. And the main reason often that's articulated is privacy. But in these cases, it's not really privacy. What it really is it's a pushback because somebody all of a sudden realized there's money in that data. The person holding the data who collected the individual's data can now realize that there's a strategic opportunity if I share, Comcast could realize it or may have realized that there's a money to be gained by sharing what you're watching on your TV or at least what the video box is displaying to you to someone who's going to sync up with your grocery card purchases to see if you're responsive to advertising, for example. So we've seen a lot of these kinds of things. And so the reason, of course, is that just there's money to be had. Okay, and there's a lot of computer science things that are coming onto the scene that could help there. But let's get back to our problem. Let's get back to the bioterrorism surveillance problem that we're going to solve, and now we've got even less time to solve it in with that little side effect. So the first thing we need to do is figure out what I mean by a bioterrorist attack. So I want to go back in time. The year is 2000. I was a professor at Carnegie Mellon. And so where were you in 2000? In what, did you say med school?
Middle school.
I'm like, whoa. Wow. Okay, so you guys were in middle school. Well, while you were in middle school, there was this group of generals in the Department of Defense who had become very alarmed. And then they'd gone to Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter had made some money available. And they came to Pittsburgh because we were in Pennsylvania. So that's why we got the call. And Arlen Specter is our senator. And they were very concerned about a terrorist attack. They voiced a lot of concern that they really couldn't get the FBI and other agencies to really take it seriously, but they had become convinced that something was going to happen and that we needed to get ready. And they were adamantly convinced it was going to be a bioterrorist attack, and they were going to start their own surveillance system. The problem is that if nothing happened, they would be court-martialed. And they were very afraid of this. So they wanted to do a surveillance system in which privacy could be protected, which is why I was there. And there have been some bioterrorist threats. Even here, as you know, in October of 2001, anthrax showed up in the mail. And there were some other incidents as well that we can think of where there have been. But what we were trying to defend against back then was sort of small. It wasn't just anthrax, though anthrax was the number one model that was used. But sort of the same kind of issues could be made for some of these others as well. So let me tell you a little bit about anthrax. The models that we were working with, there was an airplane involved in the terrorist attack, but the airplane always flew over a big site where people were gathered. It was usually a Pitt football team game or a Steelers game. And it would drop like a powder, and nobody really noticed. Some people might have noticed, no one really noticed. People would then go home, and then they'd start acting like they had the flu. So then they'd start, going to the store, buying their cough medicine and their throat lozenges and their tissues and so forth, taking off time from school or from work. And then they would feel like they got better, and then they would get horribly sick. They'd start showing up into the hospitals. And eventually people would start dying, and it's not until, but they would never be diagnosed with anthrax. They would die of things like heart failure and things like that. And meanwhile, the site is still contaminating more and more people because the site is still contaminated. The model that we had actually models from a 1979 accidental release of anthrax in the Soviet Union. It was a plant that was making anthrax, and one of the workers was hot that day and had opened one of the vents. And they log everything, but it was right at the end of his shift, and he forgot to write a note to the next guy who came on that he had opened the vent. So the next guy comes on, they bring up the plant, the anthrax goes out the vent, and it makes a plume, and everything pretty much over time died that was in the path of the wind. You could just sort of see the wind path. And that was all the data that we had. And this is sort of what you see. All of the people die. And this, it was a pretty rural area, which is why it wasn't huge numbers. But the green line is sort of the symptoms that I describe of feeling like you have the flu. The pink is when they finally start showing up in the hospital, and then the progression towards death. So what we wanted to do with our bioterrorism surveillance system is try to follow this green line. Can we tell how many people are acting ill in the general population? That is, can I do a surveillance and just sort of look at the people and see how many people might think they have the cold or that kind of thing, or how many students might be absent from school? So that's what we mean about, that's our model for what we're trying to solve, is the bioterrorist attack. Now, the next question is, how can we know whether there's an unusually high absenteeism? So now we're ready to build our surveillance system. Anybody have an idea what we should just do? Anybody, or in particular, the first idea that came to everyone's mind? So, to make sure you understand the setting, this was in the Washington, D.C. area. This is part of the Essence 2 system, and it covered the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, that huge area. There's one here in the Boston area. They're all over the United States now. So that's where we are. We're in that setting. What's our first idea? Anybody have an idea? Yes, sir.
We like streamline all the absentee.
I like your thinking. That's exactly what our idea. So look, well, we didn't say. They said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to tell all the schools, for example, send us the names and addresses of the students who are absent. Sounds pretty good, right? What's wrong with this idea? Why did it flop? Okay. It's a privacy problem. What privacy problem? Right. So obviously none of you were in law school in 2000. Because there's this law called FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Protection Act. Yeah, Rights and Privacy Act. And so it applies primarily to educational information about the disclosure of it. So here at Harvard, you guys all are under FERPA too. And now that most of you are over 18, you get to actually, instead of your parents, Harvard has to have your consent in order to give out information about you, certain kinds of information. And so I'm going to go through this a little quickly. I'm not going to go through a lot of it, but basically FERPA is trying to address what the schools can and can't give out about you. There was a hand up. So there's a pragmatic part of this. One thing is FERPA just recently was changed by another act, which has sort of changed a little bit of these rules in the direction that it doesn't require the Patriot Act to oversee them. I think your concern is right on target because, so 9/11 happened. It was, I think, a Monday or a Tuesday. And by that Friday, I got a phone call from the Department of Education because of just what you said. That is that law enforcement and the intelligence community wanted the school records of every international student. And they wanted to say, no, FERPA doesn't allow it, but we'll see if we can get you anonymized data. And, of course, you know, law enforcement and intelligence community laughed at that idea. And so I didn't get a call back after that Friday. But they did, in fact, get the data. So I don't believe that the Patriot Act was their mechanism. They had a special provision written into some law that had nothing to do with anything. It was just a special provision that allowed, under certain circumstances, educational data to go to law enforcement. And I don't think that they ever retrofitted the Patriot Act for that. I just know that they had a special provision in a law. I forget what the law was for, but it had nothing to do with anything that you would think. It was whatever law was getting ready to be passed that a week after 9/11. I could look it up for you. But so these are the kinds of things that the school can disclose without your permission. And then there's this interesting provision. It says that, look, anything that's in the school gets to decide what is directory information. And anything that's in directory information, the school can automatically provide unless you consent to opt out. That is, you have to actually tell them, I don't want to be in it. Now, when they talk about directory information, they're not talking about the directory on the internet. They're talking about a lot more fields. The point is, here we're really looking at the school absenteeism of you guys, you were in middle school. We wanted to know whether you were absent from school those days if you were in the D.C. area. And so FERPA did apply. And we did, and the schools didn't said, no, we can't give out, we can't do this. So now we're trying to figure out how many students are absent from school. So our next idea was, okay, well, we can't give out, well, it wasn't, the next idea that came to the system, the people who were building the system, was we can't get names and addresses because of FERPA. How about, you know what, we don't really need names. What we really need is their date of birth, so we have some age, their gender, and the 5-digit zip code in which they live. So that's a true story. You think I almost set that up, didn't you? True story. And so this turned out to also be a problem, a privacy problem, because it turns out that date of birth, gender, and zip code uniquely identified 87% of the students, roughly. So this is actually some work I had done before then where I showed that medical data, where you didn't have any explicit identifiers, could be linked on those same demographics to population registers like voter lists to put back the name and address for the data that you thought was de-identified. And so I'd done a study in the United States and showed that the horizontal axis here is the number of people who live in that 5-digit zip code, and the vertical axis is the percentage of that population that would be uniquely identified. And as I said before, month, day, and year of birth, gender, and a 5-digit zip code was unique for 87% of the population. But in general, the instinct is that, gee, the larger the 5-digit zip code I live in, the harder it is to be uniquely identified. And in general, that is true. You sort of see it sloping off. But it's some interesting data points. This is a west side of Chicago, 60623. Over 100,000 people live there. That's a lot of people, right? But yet, people tend, over the age of 55, tend to be quite unique. And some of that reason is because that's also where the large Cook County jail is. And some of the people who are there tend not to be older. And they're also distorting this. But the point is, here is a zip code, over 100,000 people. And it's still some people who tend to be uniquely identified. Here's another interesting data point. There are only 5,000 people in that 5-digit zip code, but there are few people are uniquely identified. So this is in SUNY New York, which is the State University of New York, and these are people who live in dorms. They have their own 5-digit zip code. So in fact, I can tell you a lot about them, and even though they're a tiny population, it's hard to know who's who, which piece of information goes with which other person based only on those demographics. So let me just take a moment and see if your intuition on predicting it. So if there are 365 days in a year, let's just say people live 100 years, and let's assume there are just two genders. So how many unique combinations would there be? That is, you know, if I counted one person for every day of the year for 100 years across two genders, how many unique combinations would I end up with? Some number? 73,000. So the zip code, a 5-digit zip code, has to have at least 73,000 people, right, in order for someone not to be on the average uniquely identified, assuming there was an even distribution. So for example, just to give you a sense of how big 73,000 is, all of Cambridge, if it were one zip code, is only 54,000. So that has to be a really large zip code. So in order to do that. In our map, we see that 73,000 is not down there. It's way up here. Most of the zip codes in the United States fall under that. And that's sort of why these things tend to be uniquely identified. But in general, our general intuition holds that if I don't give you date of birth and I come all the way to year of birth, if I don't give you the 5-digit zip code, but I give you the county, it becomes increasingly harder to uniquely identify people, and the number of people who are uniquely identified drops. But it's kind of interesting. Even if I only tell you the county the person lives in, their gender, and the year of birth, there are still people in the United States that are uniquely identified. Now, they tend to be rangers in national forests. They tend to be really in quite rural areas. I often call them the Yogi Bear people. But it's still kind of interesting that you can still uniquely identify them. Okay, so back to our problem. So we can't give just the demographics of the students who are absent. So what are we going to do? So I'm going to introduced an intuition that came to some of the people. Eventually, this would be known as the private sum solution. But first, we're going to look at a version of the solution that didn't work. So this is now the third idea that came up. So they said, you know what? Forget it. You know what? Don't give me student-level information from when you guys were in middle school. Instead, what I want, just give me the counts from the schools. Then if there's an unusual number, we'll come in with public health law, which does allow us to get the names, the addresses, their blood samples. I can quarantine them. You can do all kinds of stuff under public health, but an incident has to have happened in order for public health law to take effect. So the schools will just send us the counts. Sound pretty good? Sound like we're done? What do you think? He says, no, this is a trick question. I don't think we're done. Okay, so the problem is the schools wouldn't participate. Instead of giving, only a very few schools would participate. Why? Why would the schools all of a sudden not participate? Anybody? Yes?
Well, I mean, if you're coming in with like a public health problem, it's like bad reputation for the school. It's just like...
Right, it is related to the reputation of the school. And right. Right. The schools wouldn't participate by just simply sending the number of children who were absent. Well, let me say it the way that it was put to us. Do you want the truth or not? Right. If you want the truth, then we're not going to really be able to participate. And if you don't want the truth, we'll give you a number. And the reason is exactly what she said, that their budgets are related to school absenteeism. And so if they report a high number of absenteeism, they'll lose money. And so so this doesn't work very well. But this brings up for our thought an interesting issue. There's a difference between privacy and confidentiality. So privacy had to do with like FERPA and stuff, the things that could harm you, the individual, based on information about you. Confidentiality is really about the person holding the data or about the organization. It's sort of saying, what do they need to protect themselves from liability and so forth. And so now we had not only a privacy problem that we had to solve, we also have a confidentiality problem to solve. So I don't know who took quantitative reasoning 48 back then, and I don't know how old they are now. But one of them might have said, aha, I know a solution to this problem. Here's what we'll do. We'll have the public health department come up with a random number every day. And they'll send that random number to the first school, who'll add their absenteeism, in this case 12. And they'll send that sum to the next school, who'll add their absenteeism, which in this example is 1. And they'll just continue all around, all the way around. And when the final result comes back here, the public health department will subtract out their initial random number, and the answer will be no. Not too bad, right? Doesn't work. What's wrong with this problem? Okay, another trick question. But I'm sure if you had a little more time, so this is an example of it working. The random number is 1025. We add the 125 that's absent from the school, and that becomes 1150, and it goes all the way around this way. Right, yes?
So you don't know like what percentage of the population, like if there's a, like you don't know how big each school is, so if you have like 3 people from one school will be like a normal number, whereas 3 people from a small school will be abnormally large or something.
Okay, I like that idea, but what we'll do to normalize for that is we'll run not one network across Baltimore and Washington, D.C., but we'll do them in smaller numbers so that we have a sense of how big a school district is. We're going to do them at a school district level. So, yeah, we know some schools are smaller, but we'll live with that. Let's see if somebody else has another insight. That's a good insight, but we can solve that one in a different way. It's not fundamentally an error with this approach. Anybody have another idea? Okay, so this is the problem. The problem is collusion. Let's suppose people don't like school. Let's suppose school 1 and school 3 are out to get that principal's job. And so what they do is they collude. School 1 knows that it has sent 1150 to school 2. School 3 knows it got 1162 back from school 2. So all it has to do is subtract these two values. That is, I take the 1162... and I subtract the 1150, and I know that the school, too, had 12 students absent. Right? So it's not a privacy problem. It's a confidentiality problem that's now a vulnerability. So we got to solve this problem as well. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to introduce this idea called secret sharing. That is, we're going to tell every school, take your number, and you're going to divide your number up into a series of numbers, which we'll call shares, and such that when you add up all the shares, they add up to the true number. So, and then you're going to send them out to different parties. So let me give you an example. So if the secret number is 125, I could just choose some numbers where when I add these numbers up, they add up to 125. And some of them are negative and so forth. And now what I can do is I can give them out to different schools and keep a share to myself. And well, let me not get ahead of myself. So let me tell you how then we use those shares. So here's school one. Its private value is 125. These are the shares that it came up with. It sends out, it came up with four shares. It sends a negative 67 to school six, a negative 157 to school three, a positive 45 to school two, and each school has to keep one share itself. That is, I know you can't compute the sum because I'm actually holding my share myself. And then if I don't trust you, I won't even send you a share. So school one sends out to three shares, one to three school, each school, each of three schools that it trusts. And so each one does this. Each school will do the same thing. Okay, so after they've done that, that's what the total communication looked like. So after they do that, we now go to the next step. The next step is you take all of the shares that you receive and you add that to the share you're holding. So school one has been holding that 304. It received a 23 from school two and a 631 from school six. It adds those together and it reports a 958 to public health. And so each of the schools will do this. They'll add up the shares that came into them plus the share they're holding and send that sum to public health. And then public health then adds all the numbers it received. They've got a 958, a 728, a negative 1161, and so forth to get up the true number. So what do you think of this system? At the end of the day, this is just addition, right? Pretty cool, huh? Yes?
Isn't it possible to use encryption or something like that so that when school one passes data to school two does not know the prior number the school one has?
Okay, so he doesn't want to talk about this solution. He wants to go back. It's been bothering him, this other thing.
I mean, this is way too complicated in my opinion.
Encryption is easier.
I mean, knowing the public school system and knowing that they have a lot of other stuff to do, sending numbers every day.
That's okay. We'll write a program. We'll take CS50. We'll write a program, and then we'll be done. Right? But let's look at your encryption's easier. I guess you figure encryption's easier because you don't have to write the code. Is that what it is, or I went too fast? Okay, I think one more slide and we're there. So he says, okay, forget these numbers. Forget addition, because addition's too hard. Okay.
I think he's saying that, maybe he's envisioning that you'd actually have people actually transmitting numbers and not actually abstracting this away to the program.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying. You can think of this as encryption, but I mean as a simple encoding.
Okay. I think I appreciate your question a little bit better from that clarification, because I thought you were saying addition's easier than encryption.
I think he's saying the principal of his middle school could not do addition.
Yes, that's what he was actually saying, right?
Right. The principal come up with five numbers, some positive, some negative, some to 125.
Right.
You can only do it once a week.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right, exactly. But our belief was that we could take a student who took CS50, they could write a program, and then all the principal has to do is just give the number of absenteeism, and all this communication would happen in the background without them knowing about it. It would just do the right thing. But encryption is an interesting question. So suppose instead, I guess the one that you liked actually was the earlier one, where every school is just going to encrypt their value and send it into public health. Or is every school going to somehow encrypt it all and send it around? Which way were you going to do that?
It has to be sending it around. some value in sending it to public health, then how does the school know that public health won't
exactly
value?
Right. Very good. And then if I send them all around encrypted, I end up with an encrypted value for each school. Tricky stuff. And if they all use the same encryption algorithm, so they all use the same encryption program, I can actually cheat. I can know. Because I say, well, school absenteeisms are between the range of, you know, 1 and 400, let's say. 1 and 200 from this example.
I mean, this problem only exists if school 3 knows that the data came from school 1, then school 2. What
yeah.
if you keep this sequence private? Or what if you randomize the sequence every day?
Oh, I like your thinking. Yeah. So actually, we gave a master's degree away to someone who figured a way that we could actually randomize this sequence and make that work. But that turns out to be not so trivial as to how do you get a group to figure out a random sequence that no one can game. But yeah, so these are all good ideas, but that's idea 5 and 6. Okay, so back to this. So this solution seems to work. Even though we came up with alternatives, the encryption we found problems with, but then he came up with another solution that also seems to work. And maybe if we beat up it enough, we could find some more solutions as well. So now let's figure out how good is this solution. So what if everybody colludes against me? Is that a problem? Yeah, it is a problem, I said already in the slide. So if everybody colludes against me, it's a problem. Why is it a problem? Well, I got to model this as a set of equations. Ugh, now it's getting really nasty, right? And here's sort of how this matrix of equations work. If you read a row, these are the shares, and these are that sum to these values. So V6 equals the sum of these S's. And if you read a column, these are the shares that came in. So there's the one that V6, there's the share that it holds, and these are the shares that came from the other schools. So these are the values, these T1 through T6s are the values that go off to public health. So if everybody colludes, every value that's shaded is known except for the share that's being held and the final value. So if I count up the number of so I have two equations. I have the V1 equation that equals to T. That is, I can count them this way, and I can add up the equations, the S11 equation here, the T1, which I also know. Did I fall? Did I lose everybody? I tried hard. Anybody still with me? Some people actually are. Okay, so let me see if I can screw you up. No, I'm just kidding. So I've got two equations and two unknowns. Now, anybody remember two equations and two unknowns? Can I solve it? Yeah, I can solve it. Because I could solve this equation for what? How would you solve it? Right, so he says, if I solve for V1, since all the black things are actual numbers, V1's the only unknown, I subtract all these V's from that T, which I know, I'll get a value for V1. When I get a value for V1, what do I do to know S1? Or I don't need to know S1, actually, because V1 is the real value I cared about. But what would I do to get S11? Right, I'd plug it into the row up there, because now this is known, and I only have to solve for that one. So the problem is, so now we went through this really hairy view of saying that we thought we had a good solution and that we couldn't figure a way around it. Now we can actually prove we have a good solution because we remember we wrote down a set of equations and we were able to show this. Now what happens, though, is if you have two people, if everybody but two people collaborate, you're good. And why is that so? Because in that case, I end up with 6 unknowns and 5 equations. And if you kind of think about it, if I have more unknowns than I have equations, then I can't solve it. So there, that very simple principle actually allows us to have a nice theorem as to why it is you should believe your privacy is protected. Okay, so we have 5 minutes left. 4 minutes left. He's smiling. 3 minutes left. Okay. So that's our solution. Now, and we did it, and we could have done that as a homework assignment for quantitative reasoning. The tricky part about it was first realizing that we really did have the skill set to do that. That it came down to some basic algebra in a sense, and how to think about it in those terms. Also, you need a lawyer to tell you all the things that you think could work, can't work, and why. So what did we learn from this example? Well, we learned a little bit about bioterrorism surveillance. We learned a little bit about FERPA. We learned a little bit about the identifiability of some basic demographics. We contrasted privacy to confidentiality. We also thought that a lot of the ad hoc ideas that we thought would work, they don't work. I sort of have to force myself to find a way to prove it, some principle that I know must hold. And I also introduced this notion that's called secret sharing, where you have a number and you break it up. But I think the bigger picture in the light of blown to bits is a little bit different. It sort of says that if I focus in very precisely on the values of exactly what's needed, we had a bioterrorism problem, they needed to know school absenteeisms or the number of orange juice sales sold or whatever the quantity is over whichever group we're talking about, it's the same problem, same solution. That as long as I only give them the numbers, I can and no more information than they need to solve the problem, you know, I can solve a lot of these privacy problems. So that's sort of the bigger picture that, yeah, even in the face of lots of data collection, there is a space of some solutions that we can do right out of QR 48, and those solutions have to do primarily with keeping it very well focused and contained. Does that make sense? Okay. So now let me say a little bit about what happened after 9/11. So 9/11 comes along. What do you think happened? So I already told you that these bioterrorism systems are still operational today. Do you think they use Privisum? What do you think they use?
They just probably get the data.
Why do you think that?
Because of acts like a Patriot Act and just the
right.
Security over privacy.
Right. So that's exactly correct. That is, after 9/11, all of these approaches towards privacy-preserving surveillance were absolutely dropped. None of the surveillance systems today use any privacy protections. And frankly, most of the surveillance systems consider privacy a bad word. In D.C., they call it the P word. They don't even want to say it. They don't want to give it context. So, you know, it may change under a new administration. It may not. We're not sure about that. But it is interesting that these last in years, there have been no privacy protections, even where we could, where we knew how to do certain kinds of surveillance with privacy, it's been opted not to do. And these systems, some of them are no longer around due to privacy problems, but several of them were started, and several of them still continue today. One of the things I find interesting is this survey. This survey was about done on the general population, about who do you really trust in the federal agencies. That is, you have to give the information about yourself to various federal agencies. Which federal agencies do you really trust? Rated up at the number one spot is the U.S. Postal Service. And rated at the very bottom is the Office of the Attorney General, when Ashcroft was the Attorney General. And up at number three, I find very interesting, is IRS. Number 28 through 30 are all the people doing the surveillance. So this is kind of interesting, right? The very people who are doing the surveillance, who are getting the data without privacy, are the least trusted of the federal agencies. So you have to scratch your head and you say, why do we trust the post office so much? Why do we trust IRS so much? Why is that? Well, we trust IRS because IRS has a nice and interesting position. They've been shown it time and time again. If you do illegal activity, if you make your money through illegal activity, and you pay your taxes, you don't get a phone call or a visit from the Department of Justice. So they have this interesting feature where I can tell them about illegal activity, they'll process my taxes, and they don't come after me. In fact, they only come after me if I don't tell them, which is kind of interesting, right? Now, there is one little asterisk to IRS. Unless you're in the other political party, then they do leak. but for the rest of us in society, they have this kind of protection. Whereas there was an incident where in a conversation I'd had with what became Homeland Security, and the Department of Justice, and sort of recommended that maybe they might keep the public trust by allowing us to give all of our data, totally explicitly identified, but if you didn't use it for anything but surveillance, if nobody really looked at it, kind of like the Google promise, right? You can see my mail in Gmail, you can see my documents in Google Docs for purposes of some automated system running across it and things like that. But, you know, it's only if it's some other event happens do you actually get to go in and pull it out. How about that? And, of course, the Department of Justice said, absolutely not. That's not acceptable. We have to defend the laws of the land, and if we find any illegal activity, including speeding, we have to come and prosecute. So that model was thrown out. So we have a little time left, or no time left. Okay. Are there any questions? All right. Then we're all done. Thank you very much.